flip-flops, toenails painted and embedded with rhinestones. She looked smart and bored with him already. She was a college girl, maybe, looking for some extra cash. Matthew liked her right away.
Sawadee cop, he said,
and he grinned. It was his rule to know how to say hello and thank you in every country he visited.
Can I come in?
The girl said. Her English was perfect, with very little accent. Her name was Ace. Probably not spelled that way, but the Americanized version of the name suited her. She was cool, like a tightrope walker, a pool shark. She walked in, allowed Matthew to pour her a glass of champagne, and made herself comfy on the sofa. He poured himself a glass. Then, seeing that this would not be enough to slake his greedy thirst for the stuff, he poked his head outside and asked the butler for two more bottles. He understood that what he was doing was wrong. Everything about it was wrong, but he was on his way now, growing warm on the inside, jonesing for the weed and the dose of amnesia it would bring, wondering about the girl. Who was she? What was she doing here? Where had she learned English? Matthew was, technically, married. His wife, Bess, was back in California, living in their glass castle in Malibu with their two border collies, Pollux and Castor. Bess had been a substance abuse counselor at the place in Pennsylvania that Matthew had tried in between stints at Hazelden. She had not wanted to marry a rock star, and especially not one with the seemingly incurable addictions that Matthew had. But she had been undone by her desire to save him. After 6 years of marriage, she was now operating on a zero-tolerance rule, and she had announced, upon hearing his slurred voice on a call from Irianjaya, that if he was indeed drinking on this tour, which is what it sounds like, Max, then she was finished with him. Professional credentials aside, she could not take another go-round with the booze. Detox didn't help. 28 days didn't help. There had been 84 days, sum total, because the problem was hardwired. It was connected to what Bess called his deep-seated unhappiness, which she suspected had been caused in childhood by his father's desertion. Bess had developed a strong friendship with Matthew's accountant, a man named Bob Jones, and Matthew assumed the avenue Bess would now pursue was one that would lead her to Bob Jones's house. She would be an accountant's wife. She would live a life opposite from the one she currently led. Instead of spending 90% of her time alone, walking on the beach, preparing elaborate meals for the dogs, and eating only hummus herself, she would live a life with constant companionship. She would cook nourishing things for Bob Jones. They would do everything together, watch TV, have sex, sleep until they were wakened by the gentle California sun. The nice thing about Bess was that she wouldn't take Matthew's money. She didn't want money. It was useless, she liked to say, in getting the things that really mattered. Matthew had to admit, he didn't feel any deep-seated unhappiness about the impending breakup of his marriage, except, of course, that he and Bess had been trying to have a baby, an endeavor that would now go out the window. Bess would, instead, have a baby with Bob Jones, a baby that could count and add, rather than a baby genetically predisposed to drinking gin. Matthew wouldn't even mind it if Bess was pregnant now. He liked the idea of having a son or a daughter in the world, and Bess would be a wonderful mother. Her priorities were straight, and drinking, drugs, and rock and roll were all at the bottom of the list. These, of course, were the thoughts of a man on his way to getting drunk. The butler appeared with two more bottles of very cold Veuve Clicquot, and as Matthew submerged them in ice, he studied himself in the mirror. There were pictures of Max West all over the room, on CD covers, on posters, in newspapers and magazines. But none of these photographs showed what Matthew really looked like,
He looked puffy in the face, he thought, and sort of gray-skinned, despite all this tropical sun. His hair was still deep brown, though greasy, and it stuck up in spikes. He had brown eyes that had been described as soulful and deep, but the whites around them were red, tired, sore-looking. In the skin on the end of his nose, he had a pockmark, very small, which he had acquired at age 7 with the measles. His stylist usually covered it up with makeup, but it always comforted Matthew to see this little divot, this small imperfection that announced his authentic self. Matthew heard a rustling sound, and in the mirror, saw Ace uncross her legs and then cross them again on the sofa in impatience. She was not amused by him, nor impressed. He was not a world-famous rock star. He was a mess. He had had a sponsor on this trip, a sponsor who was supposed to stay by his side every second of the day, except when Matthew was on stage, and even then, Jerry Camel lurked in the dim wings. Jerry was a good guy. He was good company. Matthew had no complaints about Jerry or the ardent way that Jerry loved Jesus. Jerry Camel was a childhood friend of Bruce Mandelay's. He was being paid by Bruce to keep Max West sober. Jerry Camel, however, contracted a near-fatal stomach virus while they were hiking up to see the mystical jewel-colored volcanic pools on the Indonesian island of Flores. There was no hospital on Flores, and so Jerry was helicoptered to Denpasar in Bali, and then to Singapore. Matthew, who had been sneaking long pulls off the native guide's flask of hooch, did not catch the near-fatal stomach bug. Alcohol had saved his life. But it was killing him, too, he acknowledged, as he popped open both bottles of champagne, handed one to his Thai co-ed, and drank from the other one himself. Why insist on formalities like glasses? Ace didn't seem to mind. She chugged from her bottle. Matthew would be found dead in a hotel room not unlike this one. He was sure of it, especially with Bess now gone. He would die alone, the unintentional victim of his own hand, just like Hendrix, Morrison, Joplin, Keith Moon. Addictions were an occupational hazard, Max West liked to say, though Bess called this the ultimate cop-out. Matthew rolled a joint and was freshly pleased that he had company. The rest of his band, Terry, Alfonso, the good family men that Bruce had insisted he surround himself with long ago, were on an all-day tour of Bangkok. The floating markets, the palace that held the Emerald Buddha, the temple called Wat Po with 100-foot-long reclining Buddha, and a famous silk merchant's house that was filled with the finest antiques in Southeast Asia. The rest of his band tolerated a toke or two of delightful bud, but they would lynch him if they knew he was drinking. So, Ace. Matthew smiled at her as he lit up the joint, but he suddenly didn't have the energy for small talk, where she was from, what she was about. He wanted to know these things, but couldn't bring himself to ask. A deep-seated unhappiness. Matthew tried to imagine the unhappiness residing in him. Was it thriving somewhere in his dark recesses, growing, mushrooming? Was it really due to his father's leaving? Matthew didn't remember his father and never wondered about him. In his mind, his childhood had been fine. He'd been loved by his mother and doted on by his four older siblings. His adulthood had been a fantasy, every wish, material and non-material, fulfilled. He wrote songs, he sang, he played the guitar. He regarded Ace, the smooth brown suede of her skin, the silky line of her black hair, the tender pale inside of her wrist. She was beautiful and indifferent. He appreciated the indifference more than the beauty. But Matthew knew he wouldn't sleep with her, It was what he'd expected to do when he let her in. It was what she expected. But Matthew was all done with empty relationships and with touching beautiful girls who meant nothing to him. A deep-seated unhappiness. Matthew let the champagne flow down his throat, stinging him, nearly choking him. While Max was in Brunei, the strangest thing had happened. Bruce had called to tell Max he would be going to Nantucket Island in August to sing for Claire Danner.
"Claire Danner?" Max had said.
"I thought you would want to do it," Bruce said. "I wasn't wrong, was I?"
"No," Max said. "Not wrong. Of course I want to do it."
It was weird, the way things happened, the way the world worked. So bizarre and unpredictable that Max could barely handle it sober. No sooner had Bruce said the name Claire Danner than Max was suffused with tender, painful memories of himself as a teenager. And Claire, God, the two of them had been so unformed, but somehow perfect. In Matthew's mind, Claire Danner wasn't even a person anymore. She was an idea. Hand-holding, falling asleep on the beach wrapped together in a blanket, she was his innocence, his sight, his voice. He had learned how to sing by singing to her. They hadn't known the first thing about love, and that had been better, that had been best. They were innocent. They didn't know when or how to hide their feelings, and so they shared everything. They were kids. They had been happy even when they were miserable. "Claire Danner," Bruce said. Max hadn't seen her in many, many moons, and yet in his mind, she was right there. Her milky white skin, her red ringlets, her tiny ears like delicate shells. She had pale eyelashes, skinny wrists. Her second toe was longer than her big toe. She had a silent sneeze that made Max laugh every time. She couldn't drink beer because it made her vomit. He could attest to this. So she had to drink wine coolers. Did they even make wine coolers anymore? He'd started to believe, in the weeks since Bruce had said the words, Claire Danner, that Claire Danner was the woman he'd known and understood best in his life. Better than either of his wives, and certainly better than Savannah. And he had left her. He had thought he had no choice. He was going to California to become a rock star. She was off to college. She was going to be an artist, a wife, a mother. She belonged to someone else now, and he had belonged to many someone else's. But there was a way, wasn't there, in which he would always belong to Claire Danner. Max West, like most rock stars, had built a career on the premise that we were all, in our hearts, 17 years old. He passed the joint to Ace. She inhaled with her eyes closed.
"And guess what?" Matthew said. "I'm going there this summer to sing for her."
Ace tilted her head. "Where?" she said. "Who?"
"Nantucket," he said. "Claire."
Did he feel guilty? Yes and no. It was tricky emotional terrain. And the best thing about his love affair with Claire Danner Crispin was that before she came into his life, he had feared himself emotionally dead. The part of his life where his feelings mattered was over. It had ended. Not during the months following Daphne's accident, because those were the most emotionally turbulent months of his life, but in the months following those months, after Daphne had recovered. Recovered was not the right word, implying as it did that something lost had been found. Daphne had survived the accident, yes, but the best parts of her were gone. Her charm, her sense of humor, her devotion to him, Locke and their daughter Heather, gone. These things were replaced with anger, suspicion, and a cruel frankness that left Locke, Heather, and everyone else who came into contact with Daphne breathless. Locke would lie in bed. After Daphne had told him that she married him for his money, that she stayed married to him for his money, that he was a piss-poor lover and she had faked every orgasm with him since 1988, and wonder if the car had crashed differently, if Daphne had hit her head harder or less hard or at another angle, might things have turned out the opposite way? Might he have been left with a sweet and loving pacifist for a wife? Why did it happen one way and not another? The loss of the Daphne he had fallen in love with was the first blow, and this was followed by Heather's exodus to boarding school and then to a camp in Maine. She had even spent the past Thanksgiving with the family of a friend in Turks and Caicos. These things happened, and Locke's well of happiness and love dried up. And then eventually, his sadness and disappointment and anger dried up too. He felt nothing. He was a desert. It was easier to live this way than he had thought. He immersed himself in work. He loved his job, liked it better than the career he'd built for 20 years at Dixon Superconductors in Boston. He enjoyed being on Nantucket, part of a community where he could make a difference. He garnered genuine satisfaction from fundraising and from administering those funds for Nantucket's children. Contrary to popular belief, there were kids on this island who were truly needy as kids in the inner city. Kids who lived in basement apartments that housed 14 people, who only made it into the shower once a week, who got the majority of their clothing and shoes and toys and furniture from the take-it-or-leave-it pile at the town dump, whose parents worked so hard for such long hours that the kids were left to play foosball at the Boys and Girls Club until 8 o'clock at night with only a bag of pretzels for dinner. Locke's circles were wide enough now to include people like this. Everyone who knew Locke respected him and thought he was a good man. He was doing a job that needed to be done, even though he never had to work again. He was steadfast with his wife through the maelstrom of her attacks. He was solid. A rock. A desert. He had no feelings. Things were not good, but they were easy. How to explain about Claire? He had known her for years. She was a face in the background. He had never thought her particularly beautiful. He had never been partial to redheads or women with a Victorian pallor. He had always admired Claire's glass, but that was solely an appreciation for her work. Something about the curves of the pieces struck him as sensual, and her use of color resonated with his own personal aesthetic. He thought her work was good, technically, and he thought it was beautiful. The bubbles sculpture displayed in the foyer of the Clausen summer home had captured his imagination the way marbles and kaleidoscopes had as a child. He made a point to see the bubbles sculpture in the Clausen's Park Avenue apartment, as well as the piece at the Whitney. And then one year, on their way to ski at Stratton, they had detoured to the museum in Shelburne. But Locke's admiration for Claire's work was disembodied from the artist. It didn't explain his sudden fall to her feet. It happened to him like an accident, like a crash, a blow to the head, on the night of the first gala meeting. There was something about Claire that night. She was nervous, earnest, and yet confident, about Max West, about her glass. She had been wearing a jade green t-shirt that plunged to her breasts, and tight jeans. Her hair curled in tendrils around her face, and she wore a perfume that made something inside him stir when she walked into the room. Woman, he thought. Perfume, hair, breasts, smile. And a smile in her voice. When she was talking about Max West, she said, "Back then, he was just a kid like the rest of us." She was drinking wine and her cheeks flushed. She was a woman and a girl at the same time. when she stood to look at her own work on his shelf. A vase. She brushed past him. He noticed her scent again and her jeans. She picked up the vase and turned it gently, and at that moment, Locke's fascination with her was born. She had made that vase. She had blown it out with her own lips. This aroused him. He was shocked, because along with his emotional life, his sexual life had also died. Daphne wanted sex in spurts and bouts, twice a day for a week, and then not again for 12 months. But watching Claire, whole parts of him were suddenly alive with possibility. He might have been seeing her for the first time. Boom, a blow to the head, a blow to the heart. She took the job as gala chair, not because she was power hungry or needed her name in lights, but because she wanted to help. In this, they were the same. She was darling. He wanted her. It started out slowly. One kiss, another kiss, more kissing. If she had had any hesitations, she would have asked him to stop, right? He had been through university before the age of date rape and no means no, but he was the father of a girl, now a teenager, and hence, he understood. He moved things along with Claire very slowly, though there was a tide of ache and longing in him to push it faster. They kissed, and he touched her breasts, her delicate nipples, and she gasped as if she'd been burned. He pulled away immediately. Had he hurt her? Had he pushed things too far? She said, "If you stop, I'll kill you." And they laughed. He felt guilty. Not for himself, but for her. She had a husband, Jason Crispin, and she said she loved him. Locke wanted to know what she meant by this. How did she love him? How much did she love him? And if she loved him, why was she willing to be with Locke? Because she was willing. All through the fall, through the holidays and into the winter, she met him. Some nights they stayed in the office. Some nights they met in the garden at Greater Light, now a preserved but little visited historic site. And they made out like teenagers, with Claire sitting on the chilly cement steps as Locke reached into her blouse, then into her jeans. Sometimes they drove in Claire's Honda Pilot beyond the water tower, or to the end of Capon Pond Road, where they grappled for each other over the children's car seat, their feet muddling the pages from coloring books and empty juice boxes on the floor of the car. Locke was reluctant to make love in the car, not because it was uncomfortable, though it was, but because the children's presence was almost palpable. The Honda was a piece of Claire's actual life. It was an extension of her home, and Locke felt like an intruder. But Claire loved to have him in her car. She got a delicious satisfaction, she said, from remembering their coupling as she drove the children to school. And so they went out in the car frequently because more than anything, Locke wanted to make Claire happy. Unlike Daphne, Claire could be made happy. And this was what satisfied Locke the most, what filled him up. Claire smiled. She laughed. She giggled. "I feel like a kid again," she said. "You've changed my life." He had gotten her back into the hot shop, back to work. He hadn't thought of it as a come-on. If he thought of it at all, it was as a public service. The world, in his opinion, should not be without the art of Claire Danner Crispin. When he asked her to create a piece for the auction, he was pretty sure she'd be thrilled, flattered. He had not, at that time, understood why she had stopped working. He thought the break was temporary, a maternity leave. Now he knew the whole story, and while there was much that Locke wanted to say in response, he kept his mouth shut. He was glad he had gotten her back into the hot shop, working again. "You would have gone crazy," he said, "spending the rest of your life sponging countertops."
"Oh, I don't know," she said.
But it was clear she loved being back at work. She was fired up again, she said. Locke had a harder time convincing her that neither the fall nor Zach's early delivery were her fault, I was the one who fell, she said. I was dehydrated. I wasn't drinking enough water. The temperature was unsafe. I knew that. My doctor warned me.
She talked all the time about Zack. Locke had only seen Zack once in passing, though Claire described him as very needy and way behind where her other kids were at his age. Locke thought it sounded bad or potentially bad, and in an attempt to help, he gave Claire some information about early intervention. Nantucket's Children funded them every year, as well as the name of a doctor in Boston. Locke thought Claire would be grateful for this information, but it immediately became clear that she resented it.
You think there's something wrong with him?
I don't even know him, Claire. I haven't even spent 5 minutes with him. I only gave you the information because you seemed concerned and I wanted to help.
This turned into an argument. For the first time, they parted on bad terms. Claire was sobbing about Zack. There was something wrong with him. It was her fault. She knew it. And there was Locke, rubbing her nose in it, giving her the number of a doctor in Boston and of early intervention.
If I thought he needed early intervention, she screamed, I would have called them myself.
Locke had only been trying to help. He facilitated things like this all the time. It wasn't his job to make a diagnosis, only to put people with problems in touch with people who could solve the problems. He'd tried to explain this to Claire, but she was having none of it. She drove off.
Locke didn't hear from Claire for 5 days. 5 empty, nearly unbearable days. He was distracted at work. Every time the phone rang, he stopped what he was doing and watched Gavin listening. Was it Claire? No. Every time he heard the door open at the bottom of the stairs, his heart leapt. No.
He sent Claire one vague email of apology, then another. She did not respond, but this wasn't entirely surprising. Claire rarely checked her email. Finally, he decided he would stop by her house. This decision was both rash and carefully thought out. On the one hand, he didn't want to see her cheerful, bustling household and feel bereft and lonely because his own home was as chilly and white as an empty icebox. After Siobhan had run across the two of them together in Claire's car, they had made a rule about seeing each other during the day. They wouldn't do it, except in the name of legitimate gala business. There was, of course, a lot of legitimate gala business. Claire was working on production for the concert. She and Isabel were back and forthing on the invite design, possible underwriting, and assignments for the committee members. Before the argument, Claire and Locke had had lunch on two occasions, once with Tessa Klein of NanMag. Tessa was doing a feature spread on Nantucket's Children and Lockhart Dixon, executive director, and the annual summer gala, and Claire Danner Crispin, gala co-chair and local artisan.
I've always wanted to do a really in-depth piece like this, Tessa said, and bring in all these different intersecting elements.
They were at lunch at the Sea Grill, and Locke and Claire were sitting next to each other on the banquette while Tessa faced them, firing questions. At one point, Claire nudged Locke with her leg and he shifted away from her. They talked all the time about how important it was to be careful. Siobhan already harbored suspicions. They couldn't have any more close calls. If they got caught, it would ruin everything. Claire's marriage, her family life, Locke's marriage, his reputation, and the reputation of Nantucket's Children. The affair was a grenade. Pull the pin, and everything got destroyed. But Locke couldn't stand thinking of Claire upset by something he'd done. He couldn't let another day go by without seeing her. He decided to go to Claire's house under the pretense of dropping off a stack of underwriting letters that Claire had to sign and mail out, ASAP. Before the argument, and it couldn't accurately be called an argument because they hadn't fought or even disagreed, he had inadvertently offended her. Claire had asked him all the time to stop by and see her. It would be sweet, she said, and romantic if he surprised her sometime. Come in the early afternoon, Claire said. Jason is never home. Locke wasn't worried about Jason. He had actually bumped into Jason at Christmas time at Marine Home Center,
where they were both buying tree stands. They stood in line together and made small talk. Jason said,
Claire is really into that thing the two of you are working on.
Locke said. Yes, the gala.
Should be a hoot, Jason said.
The man was affable enough, Locke thought. He had a toughness, a masculinity that Locke lacked, but part and parcel with those traits was what Locke could only think of as ignorance. Locke wasn't saying that Jason was stupid, but he wasn't polished or worldly, and there were things he didn't know or understand about Claire. Once, after a few glasses of Viognier at the office, Claire said, in regard to Jason, Half the time I'm his mother and the other half I'm his sex slave.
Locke said, sweeping her hair aside so he could kiss the back of her neck,
You deserve better, you know.
It was Locke's opinion that Jason treated Claire like a feudal servant, and while he was angered by this, he was also grateful for it. The holes that Jason left were ones that Locke could fill. He could tell Claire she was beautiful. He could talk to her about her work. He could appreciate her, treat her gently, tenderly. He could clip poems out of the New Yorker or copy passages out of novels and know that the words and the sentiments were fresh. Claire kept the clippings in an unmarked folder.
I love Jason, she said, but he's not you.
What did that mean?
Locke took it to mean that he was giving Claire something she lacked, something she needed. Claire had sex with her husband often. She used this word, often, though she didn't qualify it. For Locke and Daphne, once a month would have been often. Before the accident, they had had sex once or twice a week. Locke feared that often, for Claire, meant even more frequently than that, but he couldn't bear to dwell on it. When he and Claire were together, he couldn't allow himself to become distracted by whether Claire had been employed as Jason's sex slave the day before, or even that very day. She never said a word. Her passion for Locke was pulsing and vocal every single time, and he was happy with that. Well, he had no choice. Jason was the husband, the father of her children. Locke went to Claire's house after a lunch with the head of Marine Home Center to discuss a yearly giving plan. On his way back to the office, he decided he would drop off those underwriting letters, which did indeed have to go out. They were behind the eight ball as it was. Locke knew Claire's neighborhood, though he wasn't exactly sure which house was hers. Odd, he thought, that he didn't even know which house his lover lived in. Daphne had been to Claire's house once for a women's cocktail party or a baby shower, and Locke had dropped her off, but that was ages ago, back in another lifetime. He turned onto Claire's Road. Featherbed Lane, an unfortunate name. His heart skipping, his lunch trying to find a way to comfortably settle. He was crossing a threshold, stepping over the line into Claire's actual life. Her house, on cozy, comfy Featherbed Lane. It was different from Claire's stopping by the office. The office was public space, and she belonged there now as much as he did. She would never dream of going to Locke's house, that cold, white palace on the edge of the water. She wouldn't want to see Daphne, and Locke didn't blame her. He identified the house right away. There was something distinctive about it, which he had forgotten, an alcove around the front door. When Locke had dropped Daphne off long ago, it had been summer. The roof of the alcove had dripped with ivy and clematis, though now, in January, they were bare brown vines, and on the step had sat a wide-bottomed green bottle with the word Crispin imprinted on the front. Claire's car was in the driveway, and there were hockey sticks leaning against the garage door, and a basketball trapped in an icy puddle. The day was very bright and cold. Locke squinted despite his sunglasses. He wore earmuffs. This had become something of a joke around town, people pointing out that since he was losing his hair, he really needed a hat, and an overcoat and wingtip shoes. He felt like a salesman as he approached the door. He felt like a Jehovah's Witness. The house was a work of art. It was trimmed with mahogany and copper flashing. The light fixture next to the door was an antique. The front door was salvaged from somewhere, probably a farmhouse in Vermont. Locke knocked. He should have called first, though that belied the principle of stopping by, which was what Claire had said she wanted him to do. She wanted him to surprise her. Well, here he was. Surprise. Locke heard a shuffle, a whispery noise, nearly imperceptible beneath his earmuffs. And then the door opened a crack. Locke saw a sliver of dark hair, one dark eye, a glint of silver. He heard a noise like a tiny bell.
Yes?
Now he really felt like a Jehovah's Witness, a vacuum salesman. Hi, I'm Locke Dixon. I work with Claire. Is she here? The door opened a little wider, revealing a girl, the Thai au pair, the lifesaver, the real reason Locke and Claire were able to conduct an affair.
She out back, the girl said. Hot shop.
Are you Pan? She nodded. The bell around her neck tinkled brightly. The door opened a little wider.
Okay, you come in, she said.
Okay, I'll come in, he said. And then, just like that, he was in Claire's house. To the left was a bench covered with bright cushions and a pendant light with a stained glass shade. A door led to a silvery powder room. The floors were maple, and to Locke's right was an unusual twisting staircase with balusters made from what looked like the staves of an oak wine barrel. The house was warm, and it smelled like onions and ginger. He loved the house instantly and hated himself for loving it. His eyes darted around as if he was a robber casing the joint as he followed Pan into the great room. Stone fireplace with a smoldering log, honed limestone countertops, oriental rugs, a deep red couch, exposed beams, cherry cabinets, copper pots, dried flowers, a large oval chalkboard that said, Shay, 4 p.m., pick up rink, milk. Pan stirred something on the stove. It smelled wonderful. Behind the sofa were a few toys, a plush tiger, a plastic phone on a pull cord, some wooden blocks. Locke placed his stack of underwriting letters on the countertop next to a pile of mail. To hear Claire talk, he would have thought the house was a shambles. He expected drawers open, piles of laundry mounded on the club chairs, an inch of dust on the bookshelves, soggy breakfast cereal clogging the drain of the sink. But the house was orderly and clean and comfortable and splendid in every detail. The door to the mudroom was open, and Locke could spy parkas and boots, a pair of ballet slippers hanging from pink satin ribbons. He heard the churning of the washing machine. The room smelled like wood smoke, ginger, laundry detergent. His eyes filled with tears unexpectedly. He had dreamed of saving Claire from this place, but she was already safe. This was a home, and he was the wrecker. What was he doing? These are for Claire, Locke said, indicating the pile of letters. I'm just dropping them off. Pan nodded as she moved vegetables around with a wooden spoon. She saw him watching.
You hungry? She said. You want?
Locke raised a hand.
I just ate, he said. Thank you.
He should go. When Claire was ready to speak to him again, she would call him. He turned toward the door. Now, however, Claire would know he'd been here and hadn't made a point to see her, and what kind of message would that send? He cleared his throat.
Can I see Claire? Is she out back?
Hot shop, Pan said. Working.
This seemed to be an admonishment for him to leave. Certainly, Claire would not tolerate anyone disturbing her when she was working.
I see, Locke said. So he really should go. But it had taken such an effort emotionally to come, to cross the line,
and he would almost certainly never do it again, so...
He would see her. He would insist. I'll go out back, he said. Okay?
Claire working, Pan said. It not safe.
True enough, it wasn't safe. But Locke said,
Please. It's okay, she wants to see me.
Pan stared at him. Had he just tipped his hand to the Thai au pair? She shrugged.
Okay. Be careful. Hot shop, hot. Hot shop, bright. Wear goggle.
He smiled.
You bet.
He left the house by the back door and traversed the slushy, muddy backyard to the hot shop, which was smaller than a guest cottage but bigger than a shed. It billowed white smoke like a nuclear reactor. He had often envisioned Claire at work in the shop, and now he would see her. He knocked on the metal door. There was no answer. She was busy, or she couldn't hear him. He waited, shivering and tapping his foot against the cold, wondering if Pan was watching him out here. He looked back at the house. The windows were steamed. He knocked again more forcefully.
Claire,
he called. The property abutted the public golf course, and his voice echoed out over the frozen fairway.
Was this a good idea?
He tried the knob, and it turned.
Should he just enter, then?
Surprising her was one thing, but what if he scared her so badly she burned herself or cut herself? Well, he didn't have all day. He needed to get back to the office, and since he was determined to show his face, he pushed into the hot shop.
Claire?
He called out.
Jesus, was it hot!
Locke whipped off his earmuffs and unbuttoned his coat. It had to have been well over 100 degrees in there. The furnace was roaring like a dragon. Locke's eyes were drawn to the dazzling brightness. It was like looking at the inside of a star. He closed his eyes, and amorphous green blobs danced around.
Be careful.
He had been here 10 seconds, and already he'd burned his retinas. When he opened his eyes again, he saw Claire across the room, in a white tank top and jeans and clogs. If he hadn't known it was her, she would have been unrecognizable. Her hair was gathered in a very tight bun, and she wore large plastic welder's goggles. She was just stepping away from the furnace with a molten blob of glass on the end of a pipe. She turned the pipe deftly so that the blob became a uniform sphere, a perfect globe of yellow jelly. Locke yanked at his tie. It was sweltering, nearly unbearable in here. How did Claire stand it? He noticed she was sweating. Her tank top was damp and clung to her. She hadn't seen him yet, and he wasn't sure how to announce his presence without scaring the bejesus out of her. He was fascinated, too, by her movements, by the way she held the pipe, by the way she manipulated the hot glass. The glass was like a living thing on the end of the pipe, with a mind of its own. It wanted to go one way, Claire coaxed it another. She held the pipe to her mouth and blew, and the blob expanded like a balloon. She made it look effortless. She twisted the pipe some more. She lay the balloon against a metal table and rolled it and shaped it and opened the end with a pair of tweezers. Then she turned back toward the furnace. Locke tried to duck out of sight, but he wasn't fast enough. He didn't want to scare her, true, but he also didn't want to stop watching her. She saw him then. Her mouth opened and she jerked the pipe. The vessel on the end of the pipe jerked also and immediately became lopsided. Claire dumped the pipe, vessel end down, into a bucket of water, causing a lot of steam and hiss. At the same time, Locke's spirits were dampened. He had made a mistake in disturbing her. He had ruined her work. He wanted to leave hastily, but he was here now and she knew it. So he took a few hesitant steps forward. She closed the furnace door and immediately the room dimmed and grew cooler. She pushed her goggles to the top of her head and blinked rapidly, as if she thought she might be hallucinating.
It's me, he thought. Surprise.
Stopping by had backfired. The 5 days of silence had been a message. She was finished with him. But then, she smiled.
I can't believe it, she said. Cannot believe it.
I'm here, he said. I dropped off those letters.
Letters, she said.
For the underwriting.
Fuck the underwriting, she said. She looked around the shop. This place is safe. The only person who ever comes in here is me.
Well then,
Locke said, moving toward her and putting his arms around her waist.
I can tell you the truth. I came for you.
They kissed. She tasted like metal and sweat. Her lips and the skin of her face were very hot, as if she had a fever. It was different, but not unpleasant. When they both went to hell and they kissed, this was what it would be like.
I'm revolting, she said.
You? Never.
My hair, she said. And God, I stink.
Her hair was matted against her forehead, and there were marks on her face where her goggles had clamped against her skin. She smelled sour and musky, and yet she had never been more beautiful. In fact, Locke would have been hard-pressed to remember a time he had ever found a woman more beautiful than Claire was right now, working, sweating, smiling in her hot shop. She was a queen.
I'm sorry about the other day, he said. About giving you those numbers, I just thought.
She put her hand over his mouth.
Forget it. I was too sensitive. I shouldn't have stormed off.
And then you didn't call?
You didn't call me.
I didn't feel like I could call you, he said. I did send an email, too, in fact.
She didn't respond. He wasn't sure if this meant she had read them or not, but it didn't matter. What the 5 days of silence had shown him was that he was in love with her. He might have been in love with her for a while, but he had never felt compelled to say it. To say it would be the ultimate in not safe.
I'm in love with you, he said.
Her eyes were wet, or it was the perspiration, or a trick of his vision in this heat.
But no, he was right. She was crying.
You must be, she said. You came.
He squeezed her as hard as he could, fearing she would melt in his arms like butter. She would slip away, disappear. The molten glass on the end of her pipe, that hot, pulsing, living thing, that organ she controlled and expanded with only her breath, that was his heart. They did not kiss much more, and they certainly didn't go any further. The hot shop was too hot, and there was Pan waiting in the house, and the whole fact of Locke's trespassing on her and Jason's territory. And, too, there was a sense that the purpose of this afternoon's visit was deeper and more meaningful than their previous couplings. He had shared something. He had given himself over, and now everything was changed. It had been elevated. He was in love. She owned him. He was hers.
I have to get back to the office, he said.
I know, she said, but one thing, please. Will you come up and see Zach?
Where is he?
Upstairs, asleep. I just want you to look at him.
Why?
Just because he's my baby. I want you to see him, please.
They entered the house together, though not touching. Pan was sitting on a bar stool at the counter eating her lunch. She watched them silently as they climbed the stairs. They entered the nursery, painted butter yellow. It had an alphabet rug and gauzy drapes, a walnut crib and matching changing table, shelves of board books, an upholstered rocking chair, a basket of plush animals. Heather had had such a nursery. Her nursery was redecorated now and served as Daphne's study, though Daphne did no actual work in there that Locke knew of, other than writing angry letters to the editor of the New York Times about the liberal slant of the paper's journalism. This nursery was cozy, like the rest of the house. It soothed the soul. It gave Locke peace to walk in behind Claire, to gaze down on the sleeping baby, a beefy redhead with Claire's pale skin. He was snuggled under a blue blanket, working a pacifier.
"This is Zack," Claire whispered.
What did Locke think about this sleeping baby? Claire was knitting her fingers together nervously. She thought there was something wrong with her child, and it terrified her. She was scared, despite the fact that Geeta Patel, a very good pediatrician, had said that Zack was fine, normal, healthy. For some reason, Claire wanted a diagnosis from Locke. Her fears about Zack were the one thing she wanted him to assuage. It was the only thing she had ever asked him for. Zack's hair was red and curly like Claire's, and his long, curved eyelashes were red. His skin was white like plaster or powder or snow or pure marble. His eyelids flickered back and forth. He sucked rhythmically on the pacifier. He was Claire's child, her baby, and Locke felt a surge of love for him. If there was something wrong with this child, Locke would help Claire find it, fix it, cure it.
"He's beautiful," Locke said. "He's perfect."
Chapter 7. He leaves her. 2. Is a French at nyc.rr.com from CDC at nantucket.net, sent February 10, 2008, 10:02 a.m. Subject, the invite. Isabel, thank you for sending me the mock-up of the invite. It's lovely, really, with the peach and the mint green, very elegant without being tired or fusty. I just wanted to address a few points. First of all, it seems you have renamed the event. Une petite soirée does have a certain continental charm, but Nantucket isn't Paris, nor is it Saint-Tropez. And the event has been called the Summer Gala for so long that I think, to avoid confusion, we should stick with it. So please change Une Petite Soirée to Summer Gala. I noticed Astor forgot to include where the event was being held, so we need him to add a line after 6 to 10 p.m. that reads, Town Recreational Fields, Old South Road. Lastly, would you mind changing my name so that it reads Claire Danner Crispin instead of Mrs. Jason Crispin? Without getting into the particulars of my marriage, suffice it to say that nobody on this island or anywhere else in the world knows me as Mrs. Jason Crispin. Thanks, Claire. To CDC at nantucket.net from Is a French at nyc.rr.com, sent February 10, 2008, 10:05 a.m. Subject, the invite.
Dear Claire, regarding the 3 points made in your email of a few moments ago, I chose the title, Une Petite Soirée, very carefully. Granted, Nantucket is not Lyon, nor is it Aix-en-Provence, but Une Petite Soirée will lend the event an understated elegance it desperately needs. Secondly, describing the location as Town Recreational Fields adds a Sunday softball game feel to our event that we would do best to avoid at all costs, and so I simply deleted the location when I gave Astor the information in the first place, figuring we would decide on a name for the location that would be more savory to our demographic than Town Recreational Fields. We might simply say, Under the Tent, Old South Road. This sort of makes it sound like a traveling circus, but it is an improvement on Town Recreational Fields, just as Une Petite Soirée, you understand the translation, yes? A Simple Affair,
is a vast improvement on summer gala. As for our monikers, the way I have them written, Mrs. Marshall French and Mrs. Jason Crispin, is how it is standardly done in New York. I agree, it is a bit old-school Emily Post. And believe me, with the divorce I am going through, I am personally loath to use the name Mrs. Marshall French. But I am even more hesitant to buck tradition, especially in light of our demographic, who will, no doubt, appreciate the invitation worded formally. Thanks, Isabel.
2 is a French at nyc.rr.com from cdc at nantucket.net. Sent February 18, 2008, 11:21 a.m. Subject, the invite. Isabel, sorry it has taken me so long to respond. My kids are all sick, and my husband is on deadline with a job, and wouldn't you know it, my au pair is on vacation in the Grand Canyon, leaving me to mastermind our daily survival. Time being of the essence, I will cut to the chase. I do understand the translation. Thank you for asking. Une petite soirée, a simple affair, is a whimsical name for a certain kind of party, but not this party. I'd rather not be ironic. There is nothing small, nor simple, nor French, about the event. And as I've said before, there is great danger in changing the name of an event that is as established as ours is. We have to use Town Recreational Fields because that is the name of the venue. Granted, it is not glamorous. Granted, my children do play baseball and soccer there, but it is the only venue big enough to host this kind of event, and it is generously donated to us by the town, and hence, the town must be named on the invite. To say, under the tent, Old South Road, is cruelly uninformative. Old South Road is 3 miles long. I can just picture our demographic puttering along, trying to locate the peaks of a tent above the trees. Thirdly, it is the 21st century, and it is okay now for women to use their own names. There is no reason why you should have to use your ex-husband's name, just as there is no reason why I should have to use my husband's name. I will use my maiden name as well as my given Christian name, because that is how I am known, professionally and personally. Claire Danner Crispin. I am not willing to bend on this, and I thank you in advance for your kind indulgence. Thanks, Claire. 2. CDC at nantucket.net. From isafrench at nyc.rr.com. Sent February 18, 2008, 11:24 a.m. Subject, the invite.
Dear Claire, I will inform Aster of the nature of our discussion. Thanks, Isabel.
2 is a French at nyc.rr.com from cdc at nantucket.net. Sent February 28, 2008, 3:38 p.m. Subject, urgent question. Isabel, today in the mail, I received the sample invite, and I noticed that although it is utterly beautiful, only one of the changes we talked about had been made. I am still listed as Mrs. Jason Crispin, and the location is described as under the tent, Old South Road. You said you would give the changes to Aster. What happened? Claire. To cdc at nantucket.net. From isafrench at nyc.rr.com. Sent February 20th, 2008, 3:41 p.m. Subject, urgent question.
Dear Claire, I said I would inform Aster as to the nature of our discussion. He was willing to bend on the name of the event in order to be consistent with years past. I, however, was dismayed, believing as I do that Une Petite Soirée is a far superior title for the evening. Aster did not see the need to incorporate the other two changes. Thanks, Isabel.
2 is a French at nyc.rr.com from cdc at nantucket.net. Sent February 28, 2008, 8:24 p.m. Subject: sense of entitlement? Isabel: I hope I will not offend you when I say that Astor Wyatt, gracious as he was to design the invite gratis, is not in a position to make decisions on behalf of Nantucket's children, and I am infuriated that he has done so. Please, I must insist, change my name to read Claire Danner Crispin. If you want to leave the location as vague as it is, be my guest, but get ready for the ensuing chaos. Thanks, Claire. To cdc@nantucket.net from isafrench@nyc.rr.com. Sent February 28, 2008, 8:27 p.m. Subject: sense of entitlement.
Dear Claire, actually, Astor Wyatt is on the gala committee. He was appointed by me, and I made him the chair of invitations. Hence, all final decisions on the invitation were made by him. He did design the invite for free, though the printing costs for 2,500 invites, including invite, oversize envelope, response card, and response envelope, came to just under $6,000. A vellum insert printed with the committee members' names will be extra, but I do think we should include it once our committee is firmed up. The invites just came back from the printer. I sent you one straight away. But you'll agree with me that we can't incur any additional expense by going back and changing your name, which, I will point out, is not misspelled or inaccurate just because you don't like it. Thanks, Isabel. Forward, ldixon@nantucketschildren.org. ccafisk@harperkanefisk.com. Sent February 28, 2008, 9 p.m. Subject, sense of entitlement.
Have you seen this? Can you believe it? I am going to be listed, underneath Isabel, by the way, even though I am first alphabetically, and whose decision do you think that was, as Mrs. Jason Crispin. It is so disgustingly Mayflower, I think I might puke.
To cdc@nantucket.net from afisk@harperkanefisk.com. Sent March 1st, 2008, 8:14 a.m. Subject, sense of entitlement. $6,000 is too much money as it is, Claire. We can't go back and fix them. On the bright side, Jason will love it. Adams. To afisk@harperkanefisk.com from cdc@nantucket.net. Sent March 1st, 2008, 9:45 a.m. Subject, sense of entitlement.
Jason won't understand it. He'll see the name Mrs. Jason Crispin and think someone is calling him a woman.
To isafrench@nyc.rr.com from cdc@nantucket.net. Subject, disgusting sense of entitlement. Unsent. Isabel, I find working with you difficult and unpleasant. I understand that you are going through a very painful divorce, and hence I am willing to give you some extra rope. What I'd like you to understand, however, is that Nantucket is different from Manhattan. Nantucket, at its core, is a small town, casual and humble, even in the busy summer months. We do not need or want all the trappings and pretensions that might attend a benefit such as the gala in Manhattan, or Cannes, or Nice, either, for that matter. I do not need or want a title like Mrs. Jason Crispin. Even my children's friends call me Claire. It does not matter if the location of the gala is referred to as the Town Recreational Fields, because that is, in fact, the venue's name. I am sorry if that is too down-home church social for you. I am sorry if Nantucket in general is too unpolished and loosey-goosey for you. However, remember this. The quiet, modest, relaxed nature of the island is the very reason why so many esteemed people have sought it out as their summer refuge. As an antidote to the big city, not a summertime version of it. Thanks, Claire. Bid for Nantucket's Children's Summer Gala. Island Fair Catering, Carter and Siobhan Crispin, proprietors. Including full bar, champagne fountain, past hors d'oeuvres, stationary hors d'oeuvres, sit-down dinner, dessert sampler, $225 per person. Caterer's note. The following menu has been written for success. It is a challenge for even the largest, most sophisticated catering operation to serve a sit-down dinner to 1,000 people successfully. We heard complaints that last year's entrees were in turn cold, undercooked, and overcooked. Our focus is fresh, seasonal food, locally grown, raised, and fished when possible, that can be eaten at room temperature, as at a picnic. We will offer modest portions of three entrees to ensure that we please everyone, and we guarantee elegant and creative presentation. Past hors d'oeuvres. Coconut shrimp, curried mango chutney, chilled gazpacho shots, smoked chicken and avocado quesadillas with corn salsa, wild mushroom and roquefort in filo gougere, crispy fried pork wontons with sweet and sour apricot dipping sauce. Stationary hors d'oeuvres. Raw bar with freshly shucked oysters and clams, mignonette sauce, jumbo shrimp with horseradish, mustard, and cocktail sauces, brie en croûte with pecans and plum chutney, chilled vegetable crudité with chive and pine nut dip and roasted red pepper hummus. Seated dinner. Grilled beef tenderloin with gorgonzola cream, mini lobster roll, wild rice salad with portobello mushrooms and dried cranberry vinaigrette, traditional caprese salad, sliced Bartlett farm tomatoes, buffalo mozzarella, fresh basil, cornbread with honey butter. Dessert sampler. Brownies and blondies, chocolate-dipped strawberries, eclairs, key lime bars, homemade marshmallows, brown sugar fudge, peanut brittle, chocolate mint truffles. Business Briefs, The Enquirer and Mirror, February 25th. Lockhart Dixon, executive director of Nantucket's Children, confirmed yesterday that rock and roll icon Max West will perform at the charity's annual summer gala, to be held on August 16th at the town recreational fields. "We're thrilled with this opportunity," Dixon said. "Max West has agreed to donate the performance. Otherwise, we would never have been able to afford such an esteemed name. Our gala co-chair, Claire Danner Crispin, is a childhood friend of Max West's. She was able to get him to commit, and we are very grateful." Tickets to the event start at $1,000 per person and include cocktails, dinner, and a 90-minute concert by West. "It's sure to be the social event of the summer," Dixon said. Gavin Andrews was stealing from Nantucket's Children, though he didn't think of it as stealing per se, nor did he think of it as embezzling. Rather, the image that came to his mind was that of skimming off the top, as harmless as a child putting his finger through the icing on a cake. He had started skimming back in October, when donations rolled in for the annual appeal. He would get 10 or 12 checks, totaling $8,500, and he would deposit $8,000, taking $500 in cash in his pocket. The check amounts were recorded in a file on the computer, but the deposits were made at the bank, and the only record of them was the deposit slip, which Gavin threw away, and the bank statements, which it was Gavin's responsibility to reconcile. His skimming would be caught eventually by an auditor, but the auditor only came once every 2 years, and he had come in September and had found everything on the up and up, in perfect order, balanced to the penny. Locke was pleased with Gavin, said he expected nothing less, patted him, literally, on the back. 2 weeks later, Gavin started the skimming. By the time the auditor returned, Gavin would be long gone. No one else would catch him. The board of directors did have a treasurer, an elderly man named, you had to love this, Ben Franklin, who lived in Lincoln Park in Chicago, not far from Gavin's parents. In fact, Ben Franklin and Gavin's father, Gavin Sr., belonged to the same social club, and it was for this reason that Gavin knew Ben Franklin was, in his waning years, losing it. Mr. Franklin was the only board member who had volunteered to be treasurer. He was the father of 9 children and the grandfather of 26, and Gavin believed he desired to be treasurer less to manage the finances than to escape the chaos of his summer household. Old Ben expected Gavin to hand him the budget and investment balance in the minutes before each board meeting. Ben Franklin came to only 3 meetings a year, June, July, and August, and the rest of the time, Gavin sat in as treasurer and presented the budget himself. Locke was the only person Gavin had to worry about. But Gavin had worked at Nantucket's Children for nearly as long as Locke had, and Gavin knew his boss as intimately as a spouse. This might have been presumptuous on Gavin's part. What, after all, did he know about having a spouse? So let's say this. Gavin spent more time with Locke than Daphne did. Gavin knew the following things. Although Locke was a businessman, his predilections ran toward interacting with people and building relationships. He could schmooze. He could negotiate with such a deft touch that the other party did not realize he was doing Locke's exact bidding. Locke was persuasive and confident and smart, and that was how he had built his fortune. Locke was not, however, a numbers man. Looking at rows and columns of figures made his head swim and his eyes cross until he begged Gavin to bring him an Advil. Gavin learned this early on and kindly suggested that Locke leave the annoying minutiae of the banking to him. Locke was grateful, and Gavin had spent years earning his confidence. The books were perfect. The auditor pleased. Gold star. Gavin's decision to steal, embezzle, skim, did not come lightly. Even though his path was clear and his plan foolproof, he was still terrified of getting caught. Getting caught would pretty much end the life he now led, meaning his job and the use of his parents' enormous house, not to mention his relationship with his parents, with Locke, and with everyone else he knew. So why do it? To be blunt, Gavin felt somebody somewhere owed him something. His life had not worked out the way it was supposed to. He had been born the only child of wealthy parents. His life should have been easy. One of his problems was that he had peaked too early. He had been voted best looking by his graduating class at Evanston Day School, but his parents had not been impressed by that distinction. They had seen it as one more thing they had given him. "You were born with very good genes," his mother said. Gavin then attended the University of Michigan, where he nearly got lost. It was impossible to stand out in the sea of blue and maize that populated Ann Arbor. Gavin would never forget his first football game in the big house, gazing at all those other bodies